Hello. Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Are we all arranged in nice, neat little rows? No one likely to fall over? Wouldn't want to break anyone. Let me start with a fact that may surprise you. Shakespeare is a Mormon. That's not in the official history. Though, to clarify, he wasn't a Mormon when he was baptized in 1564, but he is now. Pretty good going, you would think, considering how little else he's achieved in the last 400-odd years. He hasn't written a single new play, new sonnet, new line, or even coined a new word, and yet he has wholly embraced the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. In fact, Shakespeare is in good company, sharing his posthumous Mormonism with an increasingly large percentage of the dead population of the world. Not that he or anyone else in the whole of human history have a choice in the matter. You are converted to Mormonism in absentia, so long as you are dead or unable to resist, and affirms the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, God is not going to forget it. I imagine this must be something of an embarrassment for poor old Shakespeare. It's difficult enough to tell at this distance of the centuries whether he was a committed Protestant, a covert Catholic, or something pragmatic in between. So just imagine how embarrassing it would be safely ensconced in heaven at some super-heavenly literary gathering, swapping witticisms with Dickens or Dr. Johnson, only to be pulled to one side by an officious Saint Peter who requires total compliance with the entry regulations into heaven, and, excuse me, Mr. Shakespeare, could you please explain this Mormon stamp on your soul's entry visa? One can imagine Shakespeare's eyes rolling in irritation. If, that is, this isn't complete nonsense. Which it is, I think. It can be so confusing. You see, there is so much nonsense that flies around, positively whizzes round the shiny, shiny, bald head of Shakespeare, that it becomes very difficult to know what is true anymore. My previous papers on the life of Shakespeare have rested on small details in an already well-established life and times. I don't know whether you've heard of me. I am Professor Luard Ashbourne. No? No one? I created a bit of a flutter a few years back with my treatise on Shakespeare's probable collar and shirt size at the time of writing As You Like It. But that was but a drop in the ocean of Shakespearean studies, and has created no great sea change in the multiple views available of the man himself. Who was Shakespeare? I'm sure many of you know already. Some of you will be mini-experts, some of you will know nothing. Who Shakespeare was has long been a bone of contention for historians, fought over in many cruel and internecine struggles, sometimes even leading to bloodshed and actual bodily harm. The 1976 Shakespeare Conference of Stratford, New Hampshire, led to a pitched battle in which over 40 scholars were injured and the guest speaker killed. Luckily, they were all American, so it didn't matter much. Shakespeare's early life is filled with gaps and half-truths. Some people, most people, believe he was an actor and playwright from Stratford-upon-Avon, who wrote some of the best plays in history. And Two Gentlemen of Verona. But some people have attested that he didn't, couldn't have written the plays at all. They say he was just the front man for another writer, disseminating the work of this other to the world. Those who believe in Shakespeare as author, are Stratfordians. Those who believe in a secret other are anti-Stratfordians. And like matter and antimatter, if the two meet, there's an explosion. I want to tell you of the struggle I've had with the Shakespeare authorship question, because it's all too easy to become blinkered by one's own version of events and ignore any other interpretation that might come your way. We may think we know the reasons why the authorized version stands, and why we say that other versions are by cranks, but I decided, for complete impartiality, I would put all the theories to the test, examine them without rancor or discrimination, and see what I discovered. As it happened, I made a discovery, but even if I hadn't, I would have had enough evidence to show that at the very least there is a terrible conspiracy against those who oppose the Shakespeare-Stratford interpretation. A conspiracy. I hear you cry. Isn't that a bit far-fetched? But think about it. If your whole life, career, and prospects were reliant on the existence of Shakespeare, would you cavil at a few lies? Wouldn't you fight dirty? The markets are capricious, and some of us have mortgages. It's a conspiracy of historians whose careers and incomes are dependent on Shakespeare for their bread and butter. How do I know that this conspiracy is happening? Because they're after me. I've been followed and thwarted by their minions a dozen times, but not tonight. I've been vigilant tonight, and careful to keep out anyone who I suspect of being on their side. You may think I'm paranoid. Once I tell you how to spot them, you too will see them. Do not make the mistake of expecting some black-clad, sunglassed FBI agent. Remember who is at the center of this conspiracy. Academics. So it wasn't until I spotted that I had seen a man in a tweed jacket with leather patches on the elbows. More than once. Then I knew what they looked like. The moment I questioned Shakespeare's existence, I was followed day, night, and in between. We are not alone. But I get ahead of myself. I start with the facts that people say about Shakespeare. He was born in Stratford in 1564, son of a glover, educated probably at the local grammar school before marrying an older woman, Anne Hathaway, who was pregnant at the time. He then disappeared for a few years, doing we know not what, before turning up in London, acting in plays and writing them too. His early history plays and comedies were hugely popular, and he soon became a part owner of a theatre company, their resident playwright, eventually at his most famous home, the Globe Theatre. He earned enough money to buy big fat bits of property back home and became a gentleman. During his professional life, he wrote a little under 40 plays, mostly by himself, but some collaboratively, before returning home to Stratford to die in 1616. Some 7 years later, A Complete Dramatic Works was published, which is known as the First Folio. This saved many of his plays and helped make his name through the centuries. This is the authorized version. The Stratford interpretation. And the Stratford interpretation is made up of a number of small facts, bald facts. And these bald facts, bald as the man himself, are what is questioned by anti-Stratfordians. And for good reason. There is one fact in those I have listed above that obviously raises serious doubts as to his abilities as a writer. I've mentioned this fact several times now. Some of you may have guessed it. Yes, he was bald. And that's a fact that no one seems to have leapt upon. Could a man as obviously bald as he have written such brilliant plays? Surely his natural inferiority complex, because bald people are naturally somewhat inferior, would have driven him to write far less good work. Is it plausible that a man from the outskirts of Birmingham, with all the disadvantages that come from that locality, who suffered from crippling baldness, could have written a sentence, let alone the immortal lines? Is his head worth a hat, or his chin worth a beard? I think not. There is at least a reasonable doubt. I'm sure you'll agree. Reasonable doubt to doubt that this shiny, baldy, bald man could be the genius who wrote some of the greatest poetry of his age. And two gentlemen of Verona. So I made a comparative study of bald writers through history. Almost all of the men I looked at had a fine head of hair, only to be seen shrinking as their writing powers decreased. There were exceptions. Dostoevsky was quite bald, but he's Russian, so he doesn't count. Not only that, and I think this is a clincher, pretty much every female writer in history has had a full head of hair. Conclusive proof that you can't write Pride and Prejudice if you're a baldy. If, that is, this wasn't complete nonsense, which it is, I think. So, let us follow in the footsteps of reasoning of the anti-Stratfordians. Shakespeare, a provincial actor, couldn't have written these great works. It is argued that only the aristocratic class could have done this. The theory is that an other wrote the plays and passed them on to Shakespeare, actor, to stage. But why would another writer need to do this? Well, most candidates as members of the aristocracy wouldn't want to be seen writing plays anything so low. And unless you were a well-travelled aristocrat who knew the world, how could you write so convincingly about it? Surely it's beyond belief that some Midland lad made it up. Mark Twain said, "You can only write what you know." Sir Arthur Conan Doyle couldn't have written the Sherlock Holmes stories without working with a brilliant physician and detective himself. Jane Austen couldn't have written about a load of annoying young women if she hadn't actually been one. And H.G. Wells couldn't have written The Time Machine if he hadn't built one himself and travelled into a distant future where Morlocks ruled the world. And there is one piece of evidence that clearly shows that the plays of Shakespeare were written by an aristocrat. And it is one of omission. At no point in the whole canon of Shakespeare do we have a single reference to cheese. You would expect the rich to mention meat and lots of it, but a good country lad would surely mention cheese. In the thousands of words he produced, not a mention. I bet Ben Jonson mentions cheese in every play. I bet they're shoving it down their throats every other scene. But Shakespeare? Not a mention. And why? Because he's an aristo and too busy scoffing swan! If, that is, this wasn't complete nonsense. Which it is. There's cheese in King Lear. I think. So, who do we have as an alternative Shakespeare? Well, there's a list. It's quite long. Anyone writing at the time, really? Such luminaries as Sir Francis Bacon, Edward de Vere, Mary Sidney, and even Sir Walter Raleigh, noted explorer and inventor of the bicycle. This circle of aristocrats were pure men of high breeding, who loved a bit of foreign travel and adventure. So we'll start with the first name on our list, Sir Francis Bacon. What is the case for Bacon beyond a frap? Well, he's of the period, and he did write a lot. Poetry, essays, translations, cryptography. He was what is professionally known as a smartass. Naturally, he must be the one who wrote the greatest works of dramatic literature ever written. And Two Gentlemen of Verona. But for this to work, Bacon must have passed his plays on to the actor Shakespeare, which means that Shakespeare and Bacon are inextricably linked. For ease of reference, I have christened this dual relationship Bakespeare, and the study of this field Bakespeareology, trademark pending. But to take the Bacon claim further, there must be proof, apparently. And the best place to look for that is the First Folio. Bacon loved a good cipher, and it is known that he hid messages in the other works what he wrote. He would do this via the medium of the font. Not the thing you baptize children in, but the typefaces he used. One thing you'll notice if you haven't got a wife anymore is that the fonts used throughout the First Folio change. Sometimes they are regular. Sometimes single letters are completely different. It's like reading Times New Roman punctuated with random bursts of Arial, or worse, Comic Sans. But if you look at these letters, they make up a secret message from Bakespeare. Trademark pending.
Trademark pending.
Aha! I hear you cry. You need to get out more. Yes, but you'll be glad I briefly suffered from scurvy, because here is the answer to the problem. Through the medium of the font, Bakespeare, trademark pending, speaks to us. Put those errant words and letters together, and the changing fontage in the first folio reveals whole new plays unknown to scholars. So, I spent a weekend with a pair of scissors and a facsimile folio, carefully pasting together all the errant fonts, and soon the text of an unknown Bakespeare, trademark pending, play emerged. It was a fairly destructive process, but I never liked Troilus and Cressida anyway. I mean, who does? I mean, seriously, it's interminable. So, here is the play that was hidden in the fonts of the first folio, the first lines of a lost Shakespearean trademark pending play. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Remarkably similar to Pride and Prejudice. In fact, I never liked Jane Austen. That was always a bone of contention between my wife and I. I liked Shakespeare, she liked Austen. I mean, not a single decent battle in Austen. Not worth it. Does anyone get a hand chopped off or anything? No! But I was sure that there must be more evidence hidden in the plays, so I created a complex codex device to decipher the text. This is a mathematically precise machine, easily made at home. I made mine in the kitchen with the help of a table, some chairs, a portmanteau, a pedal bin, a corkscrew, a broom handle, sticky-backed plastic, and a lot of swearing. I then cut up a facsimile of the first folio, sticking the pages together into a never-ending circle of paper, like the paper on a printing press, and fed the text into the machine to come up with a decoded selection of words. And the best way to choose words is by the highly Baconian process of random selection. My machine rotated the text round and round and round and round my head, and as the words of Shakespeare, trademark pending, spun past me, I would choose which other words jumped out at me, and then, looking at one of the codes, Bacon would probably have left, as if he could really have been bothered, decipher the play. It took me about 50 goes, but in the end I managed to get my machine to say, I, Bacon, Francis, Sir, did write these words, you're a failure as a man. Proof positive that Bacon was the author of the text. Unfortunately, I'd already cut up my facsimile first folio for fonts, so the book I used was less Shakespeare, more a Penguin edition of Pride and Prejudice. My wife must have left it behind, and I wasn't going to be giving it back to her. Scissors were too good for it. But there is a perfectly reasonable explanation why Sir Francis Bacon laid claim to writing the works of Jane Austen. Obviously, his spirit had continued to write using her body. Bakespeare, trademark pending, was still writing from beyond the grave. If that is... this wasn't complete nonsense. Which it is. I think. But still, no proof, so there was only one option left, and that was to hunt for the hidden manuscripts that Bacon probably left buried somewhere in the countryside, lost plays hidden away in secret locations, waiting to be unearthed to prove to the world that he was the man behind Shakespeare. I abandoned my codex machine in the kitchen, or rather I abandoned the kitchen, as the machine was so big and so full of scrap paper that I couldn't get in any more. So I retired to my bedroom, where I laid out my plans on the duvet. First, I needed to get some coordinates for the buried manuscript. I added any numbers I found in the players up together, added to them by 37, times them by 1,616, subtracted 1,564, divided them by 154, then added a bit, and came up with a set of coordinates to begin my hunt with, so long as I took a few numbers off the end. Otherwise, it was a perfect match, which was lucky, really, because I don't think Bacon was alive for the first Ordnance Survey map. It was vital, however, that I didn't let the leather patches know what I was doing. So I burnt my notes, which didn't go awfully well as I started a slightly larger fire in my bedroom than planned, gutting the room completely. But luckily, I was able to put it out before it spread to the rest of the house. So now I have to sleep in Mother's room, which I haven't dared clear out since she died. With the coordinates safe in my mind, I gathered tools for the digging operation, but to throw the leather patches off the scent, I started a small DIY project in the bathroom to make my tool hoard look as unsuspicious as possible. It was unfortunate in a sense, as I now have to go next door to have a shower, though my improvised latrine in the garden is very effective. Thank goodness for Mother's love of Lilandi. Were my precautions against the leather patches necessary, you ask? Well, two young girls came to the door when I'd just about finished cleaning up the water from a burst pipe I'd found.
Hello, Dad, one of them said. Mum says you have us this weekend.
But I stopped listening to her words because I could see. She was wearing leather patches. They both were. Even my own kin were in league with them. Are you all right, Dad? The Judas child asked.
I can't see you now,
I said.
I'm not wearing my receiving trousers,
and I slammed the door in their faces. They wanted to know what I was doing, but they couldn't see. But just in case they could, I decided to use the floorboards from the hallway and the living room to block up the windows in the front of the house. It does mean it gets a trifle dark inside, but that's what lights are for. Then I decided I hadn't gone far enough, so I piled all the furniture up in front of the against the doors. It takes a good hour to get in and out of the house now once I've defused the booby traps, but it's worth it. I left to dig up the proof I needed after 11 p.m. Though in my care to shake off anyone tailing me, it wasn't until well past 3 in the morning that I was able to put Pick to Ashfold in Bay 4 for Ipswich branch of Aldi on 14 Meredith Road, IP16EB. Sadly, the forces of darkness were one step ahead of me. Within minutes of my assault on the Bakesbearian trademark pending stronghold, a man came running towards me. At first sight, I thought he might be on my side. He was, after all, wearing a rather natty blue jumper. But even on a jumper, I could see the patches, the leather patches. He might call himself security, but I knew he was in on it. I ran away as fast as I could and barricaded myself in the cupboard under the stairs for a good 4 hours. Before a crick in my neck sent me to bed with some painkillers. I think they were painkillers. I found them in Mother's bedside cabinet. Though I didn't sleep much, as the watching eyes of my mother's China doll collection kept me awake. I'm sure some of them blink. But by now it was clear that the rewards of the Bakespeare trademark pending campaign were few. I had no new proof to help advance the cause beyond that Bacon had definitely written Pride and Prejudice. I had to admit that, sadly, there was not enough evidence. The Bakesperian trademark pending theory had to be dismissed. But the continued surveillance by leather-patched individuals meant I must be travelling along the right lines. They were obviously defending Shakespeare's name from some other claimant. So I turned my attention to the next name on the list. Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford. Now, de Vere had several disadvantages when it came to writing the plays, not least dying over a decade earlier than Shakespeare, but some writers are incorrigible workaholics. As the ghost of Bacon proves. Ooh.
careful reading of the text suggested that De Vere painstakingly introduced his name into every single play.
De Vere? Hmm? Remove the D, and what do you get? Hmm? Ever. Hmm? Right, now remove the E on the end. Ever. Ever. This word is used thousands of times in the canon, and that's before you extend your search to the word every or never. This is irrepressible proof that De Vere wrote all of the plays of Shakespeare. As well as War and Peace, Don Quixote, The Communist Manifesto, The Satanic Verses, The Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and of course Pride and fucking Prejudice. And that's before you get to the obvious truth put forward by all true Oxfordians that De Vere was the secret lover of Queen Elizabeth I, and that she gave birth to the Earl of Southampton, who was one of the fake Shakespeare's patrons. Not only that, but De Vere was already the son of Elizabeth I, making her his mother and lover, and his son his brother. Incest or adultery, of course he wrote Hamlet. If that is, this wasn't complete nonsense, which it is, I think. Didn't stop them making a film about it. So I crossed De Vere off my list. The next was the one female writer, Mary Sidney, another aristocrat. Now, I said I would look at all the claimants fairly, but we're running short of time, so let's cut to the chase. I couldn't see that Mary Sidney wrote the plays of Shakespeare, primarily because her writing is bloody boring. Not that I hate women, as I vainly protested in the divorce settlement. I don't hate women, I just hate my wife, Cal. The ex tried to come round the other day, but I didn't let her in. I couldn't. I didn't have any floor left. It's very difficult to receive when you haven't any floor. But back to the reason why Mary Sidney couldn't have written the plays of Shakespeare.
For God's sake, have you seen Taming of the Shrew? Do you really think that a woman would write a play where the man gets to torture his wife into submission?
Not that I think Shakespeare is exactly wrong there. I kind of wish I'd followed suit with the ex. It's not that she's a complete witch. She's just evil. I mean, my ex-wife is unnatural, an eater of uncooked crumpets. She eats raw crumpets and says, I'm the selfish one, and would Mary Sidney write all these great female parts and then marry them off to men who are complete wonks? I mean, Orsino in Twelfth Night is a self-obsessed twat, and the man Portia marries a merchant, what's his name? Best pompous, at worst a closet homosexual anti-Semite. No woman, however evil, takes the house, keeps the kids, and half my income. Which no woman would write the kind of plays that Shakespeare wrote. I was getting bogged down now in the claimants to the throne. I needed to get a clear and simple answer. So I went to the one place where absolute truth abides. The internet. Not that I had internet at home, as I'd ripped all the wiring out of the house so that the leather patches couldn't use my Wi-Fi to spy on me. It did mean I didn't have any heat or lighting. But I had candles, and I could always wrap up warm underneath the many knitted blankets Mother had left. So, I went to a small, out-of-the-way, mostly forgotten library. They used to have them, you may remember, in most towns. But my internet mission was soon forgotten when I stumbled across something amazing at the back. I was palpably tumescent with wonder as I walked into an annex to the main library, where I found a small army of researchers working through miles of ancient papers, scrolls, manuscripts. And when I say small, I do mean small. They were tiny little people, all scholars of some no mean ability by the speed at which they ran to and from the shelves, knowing exactly which tome they wanted without really looking. I then glanced at a book discarded on a table, and I saw the magic word abracadabra. Shakespeare. I asked the only occupant at the table, a little man who was poring over a Greek codex, whether he was reading it, and with his shrug, I pulled the book to my side of the table, squeezed myself into the smaller-than-average chair, and started to read The Greatest Discovery of the Age. In the few weeks I have had at my disposal with this work, I have managed to pull together a startling story. This account of the life, death, resurrection, and murder of William Shakespeare.
There is no doubt that there was a man called Shakespeare who found his way to London and joined the world of theatre, where he began his career acting in and writing plays. But Shakespeare wasn't the only playwright of his day. The first, foremost, and most important of these was Christopher Marlowe. Marlowe was a playwright, poet, homosexual, spy, and a demon, tiddlywinks player. His plays were the talk of London, until a blockbuster production burst onto the scene. This was Shakespeare's first ever play, Henry VI, Part II, which he followed up with his hugely popular children's show, Titus Andronicus, securing his place as the man of the moment. Marlowe had had enough of being upstaged and decided to kill off this upstart crow. He lured Shakespeare to a tavern in Deptford and stabbed the irritating know-all in the eye. But the bloody corpse could have been anyone, and Marlowe had debts. So Marlowe decided to use the body to fake his own death. Shakespeare was supposed to be away in Stratford, so no one missed him for a while. After shaving the front of his head to create a receding hairline, Marlowe came back on the scene as Shakespeare. And no one suspected a thing. Well, almost. So, there we have the answer to the question. The vital question I asked at the beginning of this talk. How could a bald man write so fine a body of literature? He didn't. He was only pretending to be a baldy bald man. He was an artificial bald man, a bald man with hair. Having squared things up with Shakespeare's wife, Marlowe got down to writing, cribbing his next few plays from a number of scripts left half-written by Shakespeare, which is why Julius Caesar is a bit rubbish in Act 5. But what Marlowe hadn't taken into account was that he was recognised. Recognised by none other than Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson was a rival playwright and occasional bricklayer, who burned down the first Globe Theatre, hoping to get a bit of practice in. He was also a shifty bastard, and it wasn't long before Marlowe was paying him hefty bribes, not in cash, in words. So not only was Marlowe writing the plays of Shakespeare, but Jonson as well. Years passed, and Marlowe decided to retire. It was a terrible day for Jonson, who followed Marlowe out to new place and begged him to write just one more play. When Marlowe refused, Ben Jonson poisoned his beer and left him to die. Marlowe may have killed Shakespeare, but Jonson killed Marlowe. Thus ends the tale I discovered. Having found these documents, it was vital to get them to an expert as quickly as possible, so I stole the manuscript and took it to London, to the British Library. But they didn't seem to be particularly interested in it. In fact, the woman at the desk was quite rude. This, I told them, was an authentic 17th-century document. Why were they looking at me with such suspicion? Then I saw the telltale patches of shame. Of course, the British Library, leather patch capital of the world. I had walked into the very lair of the enemy and was surrounded. So I fought them off by picking up a display stand, a giant cardboard cutout of Shakespeare's head, and swung it round in a wide arc so that none of them could get near me, and I escaped to the tube station. Once on a train, I fumed quietly to myself, watching the message board displaying the various stops. Normally, I'd survey the message board for the usual missives.
We apologise for the delay in this service. This train is being held at this station. It's quicker to walk.
But this message board had something else to say.
They're coming to get you, Ashbourne.
Who?
The leather patches, Ashbourne. They're coming to get you.
It was then, when I saw those messages on the train, that I realized firmly and clearly that I was quite
mad. Completely doolally. Not that discovering I was mad made me feel any better. Knowing doesn't make the delusions go away. Worse, because now that the seeds of doubt were sown, I couldn't believe in anything that I saw. As I left the tube to catch my connection train home, I noticed everyone from men in pinstriped suits to women in floral dresses was sporting leather patches. I knew that some of them had to be fake. My trust in reality totally shattered. I really didn't know what to do. When the giant polar bear stopped to talk to me on the concourse of Liverpool Street Station.
Hello, Ashbourne.
The polar bear knew my name.
How have you been keeping?
Fine, I said. And you?
Well, you know how it is.
I didn't, but it soon explained.
One day you're a senior broker at RBS, and the next...
You're a polar bear. The polar bear stared at me, obviously expecting me to pick up my side of the conversation, which for the life of me I couldn't seem to be able to do. I'd asked it how it was, and I couldn't ask the next question, and what are you doing now? As it had already told me, it was spending most of its time engaged in the act of being the icon of a glacier mint. As I struggled with what to say next, the bear chuckled grimly to itself. This was it, I thought. It's displeased. It's going to eat me.
You don't remember me, do you?
What could I say? Of course I couldn't remember it.
You've made your way in the world, and just because I'm not doing so well, you just ignore me. You always were a snooty little shit, you know that, Ashbourne.
No, I said, desperate not to be clawed to death by an angry polar bear on the concourse of a major London railway terminus. Of course I remember you. It's been such a long time since we met at...
At school.
At school, since school, and, well, you've changed so very much.
Is that supposed to be a joke?
No, I like polar bears. And then it ripped its own head off. Make it stop! When I recovered myself enough to explain my actions to the police, I had some difficulty getting away. I wanted to explain that I was reacting perfectly normally to the sight of a giant polar bear ripping its own head off and a friend from my school days climbing out of the hole like Little Red Riding Hood's grandma from The Wolf. Naturally, I screamed and fought off all attempts to help me. The police didn't see it that way. The police, reasonably enough, wanted to understand why I had caused a disturbance when a man dressed in a polar bear suit for a promotional campaign for frozen foods took his costume off. Of course, they couldn't see the blood. That was just me. In the end, they let me go. They assumed that I was a crank. I didn't care. That's what they all think.
Some people wear their heart on their sleeves. I wear my brain on my sleeve, and people do pick this up quickly with just one look often. I think it must be a pheromone. Some people give off the musk of sex. They can walk into the room and fill it with sex. My wife was like that. That's why she left me. Because if I give off any kind of a pheromone, it's the musk of absent-mindedness, harmlessness, quiet nutcase. So people tend to leave me to my own devices, regardless of how crazy my actions are. Take the daily routine of my researches. I see now that the annex I'd found, with its many short scholars, was in fact the children's section of my local library. No one interfered as I sat huddled on an undersized plastic chair, writing in crayon, not appreciating that the ancient tomes from which I worked were in fact copies of the Rupert Bear Annual and, most crucially, a complete set of the Mr. Men and Little Miss books.
The manuscript I had taken to be examined by the curator of the British Library was in fact a well-thumbed copy of the very hungry caterpillar.
I know what you're thinking. All this is nonsense. But it isn't. I do have qualifications. I was once a proper academicable man. My leaps of the imagination were once considered brilliant. But I did go too far sometimes, blotted my copybook, lost my job after a disastrous Shakespeare conference I went to one year, where we all gathered to confer for hours, days, weeks, years or more to bore on about Shakespeare. Old Shakespeare, new Shakespeare, modernist, postmodernist, structuralist, post-structuralist, feminist, fascist! After 3 days of this, I was in a funny place. Wife had just filed for divorce. Mother was very ill, dying, in fact. So when a very earnest American scholar asked me if I would like to hear about Hamlet's inherent femininity, I said,
"No, no, 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 no! I don't! You can take your post-structural feminal semantical cerebral isms and...
I think I started saying some very rude words.
You all... You all make mush! Mush in vast quantities! Cheese, wine, Hamlet and mush! It's a favourite recipe. Take a writer you all love. And you all love him and hug him and squeeze him and paw him and club him and beat him and slug him and mug him till there's nothing left in your loving arms but mush. Postmodern mush, mushy mush, Shakespeare mush, green disgusting gooey mashy mushy pea mush!
And it was as I screamed at them that I had my first inkling. In that moment, I realized the real truth about Shakespeare. He, the big barred wolf, he doesn't exist anymore. No. Ah, yes. No. Ah, yes. That's it. He never existed at all. None of it exists. It's all an illusion. The name, the plays, the works are all an illusion, a collusion of literature, so that instead of teaching each generation a text of words, we teach them to see words on a blank page. Whole generations of children are processed into rooms and presented with air, with thin, thin air. And we wonder that they are bored of it at school. It's because they haven't learned to see, enjoy even the illusion we're all taught, to watch a silent farce, prancing adults pretending that they're acting in non-existent plays, watched by braying audiences, laughing, extolling, lamenting at figments of pure nothing. And my kind, my fellow academics, writing miles and miles of meaningless drivel at the service of their hungry, hungry hippo of a bald-pate god, their illusionary deity, I'm completely off my tits. But I see the world clearer for that. I can finally see through the Shakespeare delusion. If, that is, this wasn't complete nonsense, which it is. I think it's so difficult to tell. The only thing I'm fairly certain of is that you are not real. I'm reasonably sure that you're my mother's china doll collection, staring at me with so many blinking, unblinking eyes. I know that they'll come for me soon. I've been waiting for them. I know that it takes an hour to get through the barricades, through the mess I've made of mother's little home. I've been watching them through her bedroom window. Hello. At first I thought that they were the leather patches coming for me, but no patches. No to eat. No, they only wear white.
And white's fine. White's on the side of the angels. So I'll just wait for them. Here.